From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, why were hundreds of would-be concertgoers shut out of a show by the Black Keys, and who's to blame for the ticket fiasco? Then I visit a rehearsal of the LA-based dance company Body Traffic. They're getting ready for a three-day residency at the Wallace Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts.
It's not that the LA scene is growing. The LA dance scene has arrived, and this is just a total celebration of that.
And how singer-songwriter Alex G learned to write a love song without sounding corny. All that coming up on The Frame. This is The Frame. I'm John Horn. How much would you pay to see your favorite band play? $100? $200? Even more? Late last week, some fans reportedly paid upwards of $700 for tickets to see the Black Keys at the Wiltern in Los Angeles. But when their tickets were scanned at the door, the venue rejected them. Chris Willman from Variety joined me in studio to discuss what happened.
Well, the issue was that the tickets were technically non-transferable, which just basically means that the band and Ticketmaster have decided that only the person buying the ticket should get in and everyone else should be barred. And the issue was whether that was communicated ahead of time and whether people should have known that if they were buying resale tickets that they were going to get turned away at the door, which obviously no one did because hundreds of people were left out on the sidewalk.
So what was the motivation for the Black Keys? What were they trying to do by not only limiting the resale but also pricing the tickets very cheaply? I think they were $25.
Yeah, the Black Keys are about to go out on a big arena tour, their first tour in over 4 years. And they decided to preview it with this relatively intimate show at the Wiltern, which holds about 1,700 people. And they sold tickets for $25, which is, you know, a bargain compared to what they'll be going for at arenas. So the idea that it was like, you know, kind of a fun, intimate showcase for fans only, and they wanted to keep the tickets limited to fans. And of course, a lot of bands talk that talk, like, we want the real fans to get in, not the people who can afford, you know, $700-$800 on the resale market. Although, you know, you could argue that somebody who pays $800 for a ticket is a fan, too.
And one of the things that happened is the barcodes that these ticket buyers thought would work didn't work. So there was some sort of technology that made it clear to the ticket takers at the Wiltern what was a legitimate ticket versus a resold ticket.
Yeah. So Ticketmaster instituted something called SafeTix, where there's a rotating barcode that can distinguish between transferable and non-transferable tickets. And very few shows have non-transferable tickets, so it really hasn't been much of an issue up to this point, and certainly why a lot of people are hearing about this for the first time. And according to people who were at the show, the whole non-transferable ticket rotating barcode thing didn't kick in until about 40 minutes before the show. You know, the Black Keys in their own statement said, we decided to turn on the non-transferable element of the tickets. And when they decided to do that is an issue.
Well, and according to some fans, they didn't realize it till they got to the venue, or they didn't realize it until their tickets were scanned and they were turned away. What has Ticketmaster and the resale site said about what happened?
They've used the phrase bad actors, quote-unquote, to refer to the resale market. So obviously Ticketmaster has a battle going on with StubHub and all these other resale sites, and they would like to monopolize resale tickets.
Yeah, Ticketmaster doesn't just sell first-offer tickets. They are huge in the resale market as well.
Yeah. I mean, I just went on the site for the Hollywood Bowl for the Jonas Brothers upcoming show, which is being billed as sold out. And if you actually go on the chart, it's not even officially sold out because there's a few, like, you know, single seats at face value. But then there's, like, scores of resale seats marked up that they're reselling themselves to try to beat the scalping market.
There's a show at the Greek Theater called Rocket Man Live in Concert. And on the website for the Greek Theater, it says it's not sold out and that tickets are $44 to $230. So I clicked to get tickets. There's not a single seat for sale, let alone one for $44. But if you click on the resale tab, you can get a seat in the very last row of the Greek for $191, and the resale fee is $43. So you're out the door almost $250. There's no ticket for $44, even though the Greek Theater and the website says that there is. And that, to me, is part of the real problem, that they're advertising tickets that aren't available. And if you start down this path and want to go see the show, before you know it, you're out $250 and you're in the very last row of the theater.
Yeah. So there's the whole resale thing, which Ticketmaster and other services have tried to monopolize for themselves. And then there's also this thing called platinum tickets they have, which apparently, you know, I haven't been able to verify, but people who wanted to go to the Black Keys show said that officially it was sold out, but that there were platinum tickets that cost much, much more. And that's basically just making premium tickets available at what they think scalper prices would be. And they've set aside some of the best seats.
So a lot of bands now, given what's happened in streaming and CD sales, make their money on touring. If an act sells a ticket for $100, but then it gets resold for $800, they're getting a cut of that lower price, right? So the acts are somehow caught in the middle of all of this. The brokers are getting a lot of money, but maybe the musicians aren't?
Yeah, well, the musicians certainly aren't happy when they don't get any of the StubHub money. And so that's why the Ticketmaster resale tickets, you know, they get a cut of that. So that's keeping it all in-house is a benefit to the musicians.
And it feels like other bands have tried to figure out a workaround around resale, and it's proven really difficult, hasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, for decades, people have been thinking they could fix the system somehow. You know, back in the 90s, Pearl Jam had a war with Ticketmaster and wouldn't use them, and tried to go with some kind of underdog services. And, you know, Ticketmaster is such a monopoly that it's just a hard system to beat. You know, the system kind of works as much as people complain about it. With Ticketmaster being a monopoly and then all these other services being the aftermarket sort of middleman to fans.
Chris Willman is features editor at Variety, where he covers music. Chris, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Coming up next on The Frame, Los Angeles has become a hotbed for some innovative dance companies. We visit a rehearsal with Body Traffic on the eve of their residency at the Wallace Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts.
At least on the telephone.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn.
The first word that comes to mind when I think of Body Traffic is vivaciousness. And the pitch is, do you want to feel more alive and connected to people? If so, come see our show.
But all I can see is you.
You guys, it has to be so much brighter. Love.
Earlier this week, I visited the rehearsal space of an LA-based dance company that goes by the name Body Traffic. The voice you just heard is Lillian Rose Barbieto. She and her partner, Tina Finkelman-Burkett, are the co-artistic directors of Body Traffic. It's a relatively small troupe with fewer than a dozen dancers, but they've toured extensively, not only here in the States, but around the globe. In 2015, they were even tapped by the Obama administration as cultural ambassadors. When I visited with Body Traffic, they were deep in rehearsals for an upcoming residency at the Wallace Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts in Beverly Hills, and the four pieces they'll be performing are all completely different from one another. They incorporate styles from jazz to modern to elements of traditional ballet. And the residency includes the world premiere of a piece called Snap. It's from dancer and choreographer Michaela Taylor. During a break, Barbieto told me about what the company has been working on.
We saw you run through a couple of pieces today. What are you looking for, and how close are you to getting it to where it needs to be?
So if I get this straight, your question is, what do we need to get a performance ready in the next couple of days?
I was not saying that. I was like, what do you notice? Because what you notice may not be what an audience notices.
We're just looking to really refine how the dancers are connecting to each other so it really feels like a cohesive ensemble, and also to differentiate the pieces. We want the choreographers' individual voices to really pop and be distinct from each other.
And what about when you're dealing with Michaela, when it's her piece? What are you looking for? Because she's the choreographer and she's a dancer.
First and foremost, we want Michaela's vision for the work to come to fruition on the stage. So that is always the top priority. Now because she has agreed to guest in this work, you know, we're going to ask her at this point to put on her dancer hat. So we'll see. If you ask me that question tomorrow, maybe I'll have a different response.
She looked pretty good in the rehearsal, I'd say.
Amazing.
Michaela's piece is tied to James Brown's music and some of James Brown's gestures, but there's a lot more going on. How would you begin to describe the story that that piece is trying to tell?
Well, I think one of the beautiful things about dance is that it's totally open to interpretation. So my personal take on it, and it's still revealing itself as we're putting in the final touches for the world premiere, but I view it as stifled self-expression, and that really Michaela is representing somebody who is very self-expressed, but there is sort of this conformist element to it. And that James Brown is also, I mean, he was so self-expressed, I think the ultimate self-expressed human. And it's that dichotomy of how do we be ourselves and yet not perhaps offend anybody and still be able to be a part of a group.
I mean, there's even a moment in the dance where there is an interviewer who is actually asking James Brown about, essentially, what the heck are you doing out there?
And what are you going to say to your fans when they ask you some questions about
it? I'm going to say, I feel good. I've got a brand new baby. It's a man of the world.
So we get to see almost a journalist become part of the story.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite moments of the piece, and I think it really encapsulates what the piece is saying, is just go for it. Can't we just dance and be ourselves? And no matter who we are, it's okay. Just express it and share.
When I think about Michaela's piece, it is a world premiere. It is part of your new residency at the Wallace, which has got to be also important. And it's probably close to a milestone for body traffic in town, isn't it? So how do all those three things come together about what it represents to the company, its past, and its future?
Well, I think this is an incredibly exciting time, not just for body traffic, but for dance in LA. And it's so wonderful for us to be the company in residence this year because the Wallace is programming all LA companies. I mean, it's not that the LA scene is growing. The LA dance scene has arrived, and this is just a total celebration of that. And in addition to Michaela being a former company member, we also, another piece on the program, the third work, is by WeWolf, which is a choreographic duo comprised of Rubber Legs and James Gregg, who is a former company member who still guests with us. So it really feels like everything is coming full circle, and there's so much centripetal force here in LA around dance.
And why was LA the right home for body traffic, do you think?
The type of work that Tina and I wanted to dance in ourselves didn't exist here. Not to say that there wasn't already great contemporary dance, because there always has been since the era of Bela Lugosi. There's been great contemporary dance. But we wanted to bring something that had a little bit more of a European aesthetic to begin with. And so there was a need for it, this world-class sort of European aesthetic. And I think that Los Angeles was really ready to have a contemporary company that was successful on an international level. So it was just a fabulous place.
What is it like to be a dancer in town? Because I know, having talked to other companies, a lot of dancers have to have other jobs, that it's hard to support yourself full-time dancing. Is that an issue for dancers and dancers in your company?
I think that making a living as a dancer is an issue no matter where you live. Even dancers that are working with the highest paying companies on their weeks off are still collecting unemployment. And we know that when we embark on this field, that it's not necessarily going to be the most lucrative, but it might be the most rewarding path.
We're talking with Lillian Rose Barbieto about the dance company Body Traffic. I want to ask you about one of the Peggy Lee songs that you do. It's called The Freedom Train.
This song is a train song. It's a song about a train.
And its history is really interesting. It was done under the auspices of Harry Truman's Attorney General, Tom Clark. And he wanted this kind of nationwide morale-boosting initiative that was going to be done through things like song. And the idea was to demonstrate, and I'm quoting it now, that America was unified, consensual, and inclusive. And the way that this piece is choreographed, the lyrics suggest one thing, and the choreography at the end about the train going off the tracks or being broken says something very different. And I think it's a great example of how choreography can tell a story without any words. So I want to ask you a little bit more about the design of that piece and why it feels so relevant today.
Absolutely. I think Matthew Neenan's take on the lyrics is just brilliant. And there is obviously some irony that you're picking up on. But we do, when we're rehearsal directing it, ask the dancers to be very genuine in their sense of patriotism and really looking at how incredible our country really is and how much we have to be grateful for. So we do ask them to step back into time, perhaps when things were a little bit more idealistic, say in the 1950s. So there, we're trying to conjure up that nostalgia for old America.
When you're at a performance space like Wallace, you are dealing with a subscriber base that is going to be typically older and probably whiter and probably used to seeing art in a certain kind of way. How much of your job is to challenge audiences wherever they are to open their minds to new ways of looking at performance or new ways of experiencing anything, including dance?
I think some of our work in the past has been much more challenging, and we found that audience members are not responding as warmly. So we ideally like to have just one or two pieces on the program that have moments that might put people on edge, make them stand up, sit up a little bit straighter in their seats. But for the most part, we want to grow an audience and not turn an audience away.
Is that frustrating, though, that you have to kind of lead them along, that sometimes you have to maybe dial it back?
I don't think that it's frustrating. I think it's part of what it means to be producers and directors. We want, if the audience is only going to see one dance performance a year, we want them to leave loving it. So we feel like it's our responsibility to make sure that they are walking away emboldened.
What do you hope audiences do when they leave a show? How do you hope they are moved or changed by watching a performance of Body Traffic?
That's a great question. I know that Tina and I have programmed a successful evening when, after the show, we survey people for what was their favorite piece. And, you know, a quarter of the audience says one, a quarter of the audience says two. And so there is something for everyone. And ideally, each piece evokes something different. We like our work to be thought-provoking, heart-rendering, and entertaining. So we want to touch on everything that it means to be alive.
Thanks so much for having us in.
Thank you.
That was Lillian Rose Barbietto, the co-artistic director of Body Traffic. The dance company's residency at the Wallace runs Thursday through Saturday. Up next on The Frame, musician Alex G has some creative solutions for his untrained singing voice. I'm John Horn, and this is The Frame. Alex G is a songwriter who has a knack for transforming his voice. Sometimes he does it to inhabit a character, but other times it's just for fun. At just 26 years old, Alex G has released 9 albums to date and has collaborated with the likes of Frank Ocean. He spoke with The Frame's Jonathan Shiflett about House of Sugar, his most recent release, and the inspiration behind it.
I'm Alex G. I'm from Philadelphia. My sister was a huge influence. She has really good taste in music. Whatever she thought was cool was what I thought was cool. So I sort of like have molded myself to be something that she would have thought was cool. I really like The Knife. and especially what the singer from The Knife does to their voice. That was a band my sister showed me when I was younger, and you know, she'd be like, check out this song, and it sounds like a little kid singing, and she'd be like, now check out this one, and it sounds like a man, but it's the same person. I think that was like burned into my brain, you know. When I started making music, I see GarageBand as this like vocal transformer where you could do male to female. Monster voice.
I'm Alex G.
Chipmunk voice.
I'm Alex G.
At the beginning, there was no artistic sense into it. You know what I mean? I was just, I thought it was so fun changing my voice. That's just the side effect of not really knowing how to sing, you know? Like, I've only learned to sing by recording myself, because I'd make songs and stuff, and then I'm like, well, I really want there to be vocals, but I can't sing, but then I just do it anyway. Even when my voice sounds very lazy, it's probably after like 50 takes, you know, because I just do it over and over and over until I'm hitting all the notes, and then I'm like, I'm good. But it sounds lazy because it's just untrained, you know. I'm still figuring out like where, what muscles you're supposed to use when singing and stuff, like. Like this music that I'm making by myself has just always been Alex G. Like my parents got this Mac computer, you know, with GarageBand and stuff when I was 14, I think. And I was just like sending it to people. Eventually people were passing that stuff around, and then they were putting Alex G just because that's what everyone called me, because there was a bunch of Alexes. I was Alex G because there was Alex Z next door. Song Bad Man. That song went through a couple iterations. The first one, I was just playing it on acoustic guitar and singing those lyrics. It sounded really corny to me, you know? And so then I tried it again on piano, doing some type of piano arrangement and singing those lyrics. And again, it's just too, there wasn't enough to it. And so I was sort of frustrated with it, and then I just laid down really quick this, like, techno weird thing out of frustration, but also as soon as I started, I was like, this is actually really enjoyable, and so I finished it up, and the country accent, I don't really know why I did that. Like, I was listening to, you know Tierra Whack?
Well, honey, I've been so sick, so sad. Whenever I'm happy, it makes you mad. I hope your ass breaks out in rash.
She has this album that's full of really short songs, and one of the songs, she has an accent like that. I thought that was a really good idea when I listened to her song, and then I think it just stuck with me, and then I sort of lifted it and put it into my song. I like walking the line between funny and super serious, because it's kind of, it lets you come back to those things. You know, I guess all the entertainment that I like walks that line usually. It's more that I just want to cover as many bases as possible with the one song. So I guess something saccharine to me would be only covering one base, and I want to cover like as much as possible. Does that make sense? Like I just want it to be mean and nice and happy and sad and all of those things in the most succinct way possible.
That's it for today. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We're back here tomorrow.